Good morning. It's just after 10 a.m. on Saturday, July 18th, 2026. We are again at the Andrew Carnegie Free Library and Music Hall, Carnegie, Pennsylvania. The purpose of this talk, which is being held in front of a live audience, is to learn more about Carnegie veteran George Snyder, Spec 5, U.S. Army, a clerk typist with the Army Security Agency, who served here in the States and in Berlin from 1965 to 1969. There are well over 500 veterans in Carnegie, this town of about 8,000 people just outside of Pittsburgh. That percentage of veterans is well above the national average. Secondary purpose of this talk is to permanently preserve it and make it available to the public for many generations to come. A special thanks to the library for that. It's going to be part oral history. It's going to be part interesting conversation. We're going to try to have some fun also. George was kind enough to agree to be the third person we talked to in our series called From the Foxhole, Talks with Carnegie's Veterans. We call it From the Foxhole because foxholes are used in war to hide from the enemy and or whatever the enemy is firing at you. Foxholes can therefore offer some comfort and protection. In our context, similar to that, our foxhole is a safe place and a safe space where two buddies can talk together openly. This open talk will be just that. We're all going to get to know George a little bit in the ins and outs of his service, some good, maybe some not so good, some certainly interesting, and the impact of his service on him and his loved ones. That impact, good or bad, usually lasts as long as the veteran lives. And as we are about to find out, George's service has lingering impact even to this very day. George and I will talk for about 45 minutes. Well, maybe a little bit longer. George likes to talk. And then we'll all take some questions for George. For the veterans here, thank you very much. And those who love and care for them, if at any point during this conversation you need to take a break because of what we're talking about, please do. Sometimes when veterans tell their stories, other veterans hear triggers in those stories. And those triggers can cause unexpected emotions or thoughts. We get that. So please, take a break. Do what you have to do. And just remember that you're among friends here, and we appreciate that. On that related note, please be reminded that the National Crisis Line phone number is 988. If you are a veteran or calling on behalf of one, press 1 when you reach the menu. Call is free, the help is free, and the reason for the call does not have to be a life or death emergency. The Department of Veterans Affairs has a representative here, Andrew Klein, who will be happy to provide more information about 988 and the other services that the VA offers. Special thanks to Andrew and the VA for that, and please stop by his table when you have the opportunity. He's got some really cool things over there that are very useful, regardless of whether you ever need to call a crisis line or not. All right, now we're done with formalities. Are you ready?
Whenever you are.
Oh, well, that's a good answer. Okay, first, let's set the baselines. When and where were you born?
Allentown, Lehigh County, Pennsylvania.
What branch of service were you in?
Army Security Agency.
What was your job?
I had a couple different training times, but I ended up as an administrative specialist in West Berlin.
Okay. How long were you in the Army?
4 years.
Okay. This was in West Berlin. What rank were you when you got out?
Spec 5.
Okay. So, we're going to talk about the Army in depth in a few minutes, but now we want to get to know about George.
Uh-oh.
So, I have a pretty big question, and then you'll tell me all about your childhood and where and what that was like. So, tell us about your life before your military service. Where did you live? What did your parents do? Where did you go to school? What did you do for fun? High school, blah, 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 blah. I've got a whole bulleted list here, and I hope you cover most of it.
People in the audience who live 300 miles away from where I grew up might not know the names of some of the places, but the name of the village in which I was reared was called Orfield, capital O-R-E, Field. It was there were three open pit iron ore mines. There were like mini Grand Canyons where they mined iron ore for Bethlehem Steel, which was just several miles away, and I grew up without the benefit of running water or plumbing in the house until I was a young teenager, I think maybe 9th or 10th grade in high school. Saturday night was bath night with the rinse tub that we used to rinse the laundry when we did the washing with a Ringer washing machine, and we had a cistern for water, and I was drinking water and also bathing and all washing and everything. The high school was called Parkland. It was in our village, so when I was in high school, went to 7th grade through 12th grade there, it was close enough to walk to and from school or take my bike, whichever I wanted to do. And my father was retired from Mack Trucks. He was a paint sprayer. He started there, I guess, in the 40s. My parents were married in August of 1941, and my dad worked in body shops and then finally landed a job at Mack Trucks. He worked for many years on the bus line until the middle 50s when the bus line went down. Then he transferred to the fire line where he was a paint sprayer until he retired, I think, 76 or 77, something like that. And he painted half of the fire trucks. And I worked in the same factory as him for a while. We had lunch together, and they had a big drying booth where they literally hand-pushed the fire trucks from where they were painted into the dryer to dry. And when Effie would pack a lunch for me, it was leftover mashed potatoes and meat and all that stuff for the night before. I put it in the corner of the dryer about a half an hour before lunch break. And by the time we had lunch, it was hot. So I had hot meals.
Smart.
And really smart. So that was a benefit to working at least in that part of Mack Trucks. I was basically a stock chaser. I also worked in another plant where they made light, heavy, and off-highway trucks. I think off-highway trucks, where they made about one and a half every 2 weeks. They just sat there and put them together as they sat. But the light and the heavy lines were on a chain, so you chased a chain. If there were axles missing, if there were bumpers missing, if there were screw nuts and bolts and washers, I had to go chase to the rest of the plant to find it, bring it up, put it in the bucket that hung in the back of the chassis, and it rolled off the line and it was put on in an area called changeover.
I think some people would call that quality control these days.
I guess. Mm-hmm. Well, my dad retired there, my brother retired there, my uncle, my father's older brother, and their older uncle all retired from Mack Trucks. And I grew up in Pennsylvania Dutch country. Unfortunately, I never learned the language. My father and his family spoke fluent Pennsylvania Dutch. I have a girlfriend. She's a friended girl, and we visit her every time we go back. We knew one another before we even started school because in the 40s, you didn't have a lot of TV. So we visited other people in the same, we grew up in the same village. And we visited people, and every church, there were Lutheran and Reformed churches and fire companies all had picnic areas. And we would go our Friday nights and sometimes Saturday nights. We're traveling through Lehigh County, going to a different picnic that was held by a church or by a fire local volunteer fire department. And we sometimes ran into one another. So we'd go running off and exploring while our parents stood together and talked or walked around and looked at the exhibits and so on and so forth. And then there was entertainment. In those days, they were called hillbilly bands or country western music. And one of the features was a radio personality. His name was Luther Geringer, but he went by the name of Dobie Duncan. And he did songs in Pennsylvania Dutch. He did Mule Train and in Pennsylvania Dutch and in English. And very fun. The only thing I remember from Pennsylvania Dutch anymore is Kunsten Mika Fuga, which means can you catch flies? Jobin Blaken Z Set, yeah, when they're sitting still. But our family reunions were the Everett family. My father's mother was an Everett. And part of the program was always a church service. And after that was over, there was a business meeting. And somebody stood up and told a story in Pennsylvania Dutch. And all the kids sat there. The adults were laughing because some of the parts were funny. We kids didn't speak Dutch or understand it. It reminds me that we also kept chickens. And less than a mile from our home was a river on which was a three-story stone grist mill built in the late 1700s. And we take our corn out there for him to grind. And when we walk in, my brother and I were little guys like this, the old farmers in there were telling naughty stories in English. But out of the respect of the children and women that came in, they switched to Pennsylvania Dutch, so we couldn't understand it, but my father would join right in, and I grew up eating good Pennsylvania Dutch food. I don't know if anybody knows anything about leaven and bologna or shoe fly pie, but that's all great stuff. And we found leaven and bologna around here in a couple of stores, and We buy shoe fly pipe when we go back east to Allentown. There's a great farmer's market that's in the fairgrounds, It's under the grandstand. It's about a quarter of a mile long. And all the Amish and the Pennsylvania Dutch and the regular people bring their food and cakes and pies.
Right.
And the Pennsylvania Dutch and the Amish cheesecakes, you need a forklift to bring it home. And they're only like this. Man, they're heavy, but they're the best in the world. I've eaten cheesecakes around here, everywhere else. They don't fly unless you eat an Amish cheesecake in eastern Pennsylvania, Lancaster, Lebanon, York, Lehigh, Berks County, Bucks County. That's all Pennsylvania Dutch.
Well, the Pennsylvania Dutch, and they call it the Pennsylvania Dutch for a reason. And this is the benefit of our future audience. They're primarily geographically, lo and behold, in that part of Pennsylvania. So this isn't a wide American story, like coast to coast, but this is a great micro American story,
yeah,
of the Pennsylvania Dutch and the good and wonderful things that they do based on their beliefs, and then the interaction of these two basically different communities come together to help each other and, of course, make a little money off of each other. But obviously, they became kind of one community, and I think that's a pretty good place to learn about that, especially for a young man in the 40s and 50s. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm 82. And that farmer's market has been there ever since I know anything, and probably before that. And we would walk in at the very far end, and you could smell the horseradish being ground. And real horseradish, not the wimpy stuff that you get in the store here. I mean, this is 9-alarm, 10-alarm horseradish. In fact, I almost died when I was about 4 or 5. Mom had set the kitchen table up. I took the horseradish off and took a big sniff. I said, "What's this?" My dad picked me up and took me out on the porch and in the cold air real quick.
Took your breath away.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. Violet's horseradish, the best in the world, still made.
So it all sounds like fun, and this was definitely a hardworking farming, labor, blue-collar type of place, good sturdy people. And of course, you played cops and robbers and boys and Indians. There was a swimming hole with a rope swing.
Oh, yes.
And your dad coached a softball team. I'm going to get to my two favorite parts here in just a second. One of those is Schenkweiler's Drive-In Theater.
Which is now the oldest drive-in theater in the United States.
Let me correct you on that. It's the oldest drive-in theater on the planet that's still
existing. Right. There was one in New Jersey about a year earlier.
Yeah, but it's gone.
That's right.
So Schenkweiler's is the oldest operating drive-in theater in the world. And you went there and watched movies.
All the time.
All the time. And you were quite the baseball player. You spent a lot of time playing ball.
Yeah, in the summertime when we got to be teenagers, sometimes the kids would come knocking on the door and say, "Let's play ball." Across the street was a fire hall. Behind the fire hall was a softball field where my dad coached softball. And we'd go over there and spend the afternoon playing baseball. And as I told you once before, that if my dad were alive today, what would I like to do with him? Play baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah. He taught us. He was really good. He played on a team when his father moved from Allentown to Orfield, and his mother died when he was about, I think, 11. His mother hated the city. I mean, sorry, she hated the country, even though she was one of 8 children born in Lehigh County up against the Blue Mountains on a farm and grew up doing farm chores. I guess that's why she didn't like the country. So she insisted on living in the city, and her husband took her to live in the city. When she died I don't remember what the year it was. Dad was born in 1913. He was 11 when she died. So that was in the early 20s. And then they moved out to the country where 4 of his maternal uncles lived. His mother's brothers lived there. Then he got old enough to play ball. And it was a big, flat area where they played baseball. It was owned by a man by the name of Wilson Schenkweiler. And he established the first drive-in theater. Then my father and his buddies had to find another place to play baseball. and they did. And Wilson Schenkweiler built his theater, his drive-in. His wife's name was Daisy. He built a road behind the theater that would have faced the screen. And he called it Daisy Lane. And he installed in every house sound equipment so you could hear the You didn't have to go in to buy a ticket. You could hear, if you lived there, you could look out your picture window, watch the movie, and hear it through the sound system that he installed because he didn't want people complaining that, oh, those movies are so loud, we can't even sleep, or we can't do this, we can't do that. So he took care of them, and he installed sound systems so people could hear and watch the movie for free. Now now there's a Shankwaller who owns it again. I think it's Wilson's grandson or great-grandson, and I mean to write to him.
That's absolutely genius. And of course, you know, when boys really want to play ball, they will find a place to play ball.
Doesn't matter where.
I played a lot of baseball on Fort Gordon, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that later. All right. So that sounds pretty idyllic. It sounds pretty nice. Sounds like there's a lot of Americana there. And I know you're cognizantly aware of the little tiny gifts that all those experiences gave you. But then, unfortunately, or fortunately, for better or worse, depending on how you look at it, my understanding is that as a young teenager, becoming an older teenager in that time period, since there was still a draft, and since Vietnam was starting, the best option might have been to voluntarily enlist in the military and perhaps get to choose what you did,
mm-hmm.
and maybe have some influence on where you went, instead of running the risk of getting drafted and not having a choice and possibly going to a place you didn't want to go. You voluntarily enlisted?
Yes.
Okay. In what year? 65?
65. Early. Must have been very early 65 because my first day was 17 February 65.
Okay. And primarily because you wanted to avoid potential for a draft.
Well, the story always was that you have a chance of getting what you want if you enlist.
Right.
Opposed to being drafted and not knowing what's going to happen or where you're going to go.
Okay. Now, your situation is very interesting because you were basically selected based on an adjudicated security clearance to serve in a particular section of the Army.
Well, I enlisted in the Army Security Agency, which was 4 years. They wanted 4 years instead of three because some of the schools were a year and a half. That was during the Vietnam era, and Vietnamese and Chinese Mandarin was very popular language, mm-hmm. as was Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And German was, you could learn German in high school, mm-hmm. you know, but... Yeah, those were very popular. So those language schools, Russian, Chinese, Mandarin, and other Vietnamese were a year to 15, 16 months, I think.
Right.
So by the time you finished over a year at school, they figured you don't have enough time to give to the Army if you've only enlisted for 3 years, so we'll make it 4 years.
Right.
And I enlisted for 4 years. I thought, why not?
Well, they wanted a return on their investment.
Oh, obviously, yeah. And I was willing to give it.
Okay. So, Army Security Agency, just for the audience's benefit, the Army Security Agency was kind of like what some people call a secret squirrel organization. It's interesting, this Army unit, this Army organization, didn't report up the Army chain of command. It reported directly to the director of the National Security Agency, which is a civilian organization. It was a critical part of intelligence gathering and communication security during the Cold War. It was in organization, it functioned from 1945 to 1977. So it was basically a Cold War organization. They did signals intelligence. We call that SIGINT. And just as a fun example, a GI in the same place that he worked later named Johnny Cash was the first American to find out that Joseph Stalin died because he was listening to everything that the Russians were saying, and that was a large part of what the ASA did. It was incredibly vital. There were no unimportant people in the ASA, and George is going to tell us a couple of interesting things about it as we move forward. When and where did you go to your initial training and your job-related training? What were those like? Any lingering thoughts or memories about training, good or
Fort,
bad?
Fort Dick, New Jersey was basic training.
Okay.
Fort Dick, New Jersey was about, I think, less than 2 hours from my home.
Convenient.
So beginning with the second week of basic training when you were allowed visitors and to go beyond the basic training area, my parents came down every Sunday.
Nice.
And so we went to chapel and just drove around. It was February, so it was very cold.
Mm-hmm.
I started either basic training or reception on Washington's birthday.
Okay.
And I graduated on my birthday, 22 April, from 17 February to 22 April. So I, on my graduation from basic training, it was my 21st birthday.
Cool.
So that was interesting. Nothing special happened, but when I went home to for a short leave after basic training, there was a hotel in town that I went into all the time when I was a paper boy to collect every 2 weeks, and the bartender always gave us a Hershey bar and a Coke.
Oh.
But I wanted to have a little something more than
well,
a Hershey bar and a Coke now that I'm 21. So I got to sit in there one time and have a drink. And it was also the place where the county, I guess the county treasurer came once a year to collect your taxes. He had a little table set up in the vestibule. My dad always took my brother and I out. We got a candy bar and a Coke, and, okay. but paid by the tax man, and he bought the adults a beer.
Huh.
And that was our tax time outside. And that hotel is now torn down. And outside the hotel was a little trough. It was about 5 feet wide by 10 feet long, maybe 18 inches high. It collected spring water from up in the hill, and we used to get our drinking water. Sometimes we get our drinking water from there or from the cistern. My father, my brother, and I had no problem drinking cistern water. My mother turned up her nose. So we had to go to the hotel to bring water back in gallon jugs. And in those days, gallon jugs were made of glass, and they were heavy.
They were already heavy, right?
Yeah. We got that's how we got our water. And all that's torn down. The legend is George Washington went through there. I doubt it, but that's just a legend. Our village goes back to pre-Revolution days. It's on, if you look at a map, it's on Route 309, which is the route between Philadelphia and Wilkes-Barre. Major thoroughfare. And we're close to the intersection of Route 22. And we know about Route 22 out here.
Mm-hmm.
If you take Route 22 going east, you go right through our village.
Okay.
Or near it anyway.
Right. So it was convenient that you were Fort Dix. You got to visit family.
Then I was transferred to Fort Gordon, Georgia. About which you know nothing.
No, I don't know anything about Fort Gordon. So this is for advanced individual training at Fort Gordon.
Right.
It was about 16 weeks long, and you were designated to be in a communications military occupational specialty, but
the slots were all full everywhere. So I just got kicked around the post. I worked in our company as a mail clerk. They shift me over to the other side of the company, other side of the post, you know, down there past the lake,
uh-huh.
and up the other side of the pole climbers company. This is August of 1965.
Warm.
Georgia.
Warm.
Warm. Humid. Like the last couple of days. Our CEO said, go over to the mess hall and get me a pot of coffee. So I walked over. I already had my ASA patch on my sleeve. I wanted everybody to know you're an ASA.
Remember, it's a secret organization, quote unquote.
Yeah, and most of the people in the military did not know what the ASA was. In fact, some were afraid of it because mm-hmm. you didn't know. The guy has a slick sleeves. He looked like a private. He could be a captain. He could be a colonel. You didn't know. It could be a civilian agent. So I'm going over to the mess hall. Coming out of the mess hall was a young PFC. He had on a patch that said Army Ranger Airborne. Special Forces. And he stopped me. He saw my patch. He says, what's ASA doing here? As quick as I could, without missing a beat, I said, keeping an eye on Special Forces. He turned and he ran. I never saw him again. I was there another half a dozen weeks, and he must have gotten to the mess line and looked around to see if I was... I never saw him again.
And I guarantee you, he told all of his buddies.
When the ASA got to Vietnam, and all the recruiting sergeants told the young recruits, sign up for ASA. There's no ASA in Vietnam. Technically, that's true. Technically, it's not.
Right.
When you got to the ASA that was in Vietnam, as soon as you got to Vietnam, you took off your ASA patch and you put on the Vietnam patch. You took off the collar brass. Remember those? Infantry, artillery, cavalry. Mm-hmm. You took that off and put Signal Corps brass on. Mm-hmm. So technically, you weren't Signal Corps, because according to the Geneva Convention, the way I understand it, were no intelligence units were allowed in combat. I don't know if that's true. That's just what I heard. So there were, and in fact, the very first uniformed soldier killed in Vietnam was ASA. Wow. He was doing triangulation and finding a Viet Cong radio. His name was Jim Davis.
Wow.
And he's from Tennessee, I think it was. Mean to go to Tennessee sometime to find his grave.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, yeah. Rest in peace, Jim Davis.
Our sergeant major in Berlin had his picture on the wall in his office.
Nice.
Thomas James Davis. Anyway, that was first man. We were always told ASA is the top 10% of the Army. Well, I don't know how great we were. Most everybody had a college degree or had some college. I took a little couple college courses in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, so I guess that qualified me. But we were told that it was top 10%. Turned out, after all, 1977, when all the calculations were done, we were really 3% of the Army. For every 100 soldiers, 3 were ASA. So,
cream of the crop.
That's what they said. I don't know about that.
But I think like it could be debated a little bit if you're actually in it.
I finished my proficiency test in reception, and we were sitting there diddling our thumbs, and a couple of sergeants come in, and they called a few names. Follow me. So I followed him with a couple of other guys, went down to a room. There's an ASA recruiter. So we talked to him. He said, "What's ASA?" "Well, I can't tell you, but you fill out this form." It was this long, front and back. Came out to be 4 pages, background investigation, and filled it out, took it back, and went through basic training. After basic training, I went back to the company I'd worked for, Rodale Electric in Emmaus, and walked up to the boss, somebody coming on the floor. He said, "What did you do?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The FBI was in here asking about you." So I know it was the FBI. Sometimes the NSA did the background investigation, sometimes the FBI, so I know who did my background. And
because that background was clean, then you were in the ASA before most people are even assigned their units when they get out of training. It was a foregone conclusion for you.
And that's why we could wear our ASA patch right away.
Okay. Okay. So one of the things that we like to do during these talks is to demonstrate to people that haven't been in the military the significance of the good people you come across in the military that stick with you. And the veterans, we can all name at least 2 or 3. Why don't you take a minute to tell us about Gerald Ulam?
Yeah, my drill instructor in basic training. He was fair. He wasn't a guy that stood in front of your detention and yelled in your face. I don't think the other 3 drill instructors were like that either. But I remember walking into the barracks. It was February. It was dark outside. And he took off his hat and he says, "I have the longest hair in the platoon." And he had it shaved close, like we did the next day. And he was just fair and honest. And I remember men who had been in Korea said, "Never volunteer to do anything, especially don't volunteer to be a truck driver. They'll have you digging ditches and pushing a wheelbarrow. That's a truck." So the field first came out one evening. We were about 4 weeks into basic training, maybe. And he said, "We need truck drivers." And he said, "Now, these were the, I'm sure you men all know what the World War II barracks were like." Mm-hmm. There were wooden barracks. We called them Splendor City.
Yep.
Because if they had gone up in flames, it would have been done in 13 minutes. That's what I heard. So he said, "You won't have to stand fire watch," which in basic training, that meant you had to get up. If it was 1 o'clock in the morning, if it was your turn at 1 o'clock in the morning, there were an hour shift each.
Yep.
You got to get completely dressed.
Yep.
Put your boots on, lace them up, sit on the end of your foot locker. That probably took 15 minutes to get dressed.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep.
And he said you wouldn't have to stand fire watch, and a KP would be easy. There were other benefits. Because they wanted you to get your sleep. They didn't want your sleep broken if you're going to drive a truck. Went forward, put up my hand. Then the next day, I was called out of formation, went to driver training school, where I got my military driver's license and drove a deuce and a half, taking troops out to the rifle range and picking them up in the evening because they didn't have to march back after dark. It was bad enough walking through the woods in the light time, in the daytime, much less after dark. So I picked up troops, and I remember we had just finished the grenade range. We had just finished the crawling under the barbed wire, shooting over your head type fun. Well, I didn't get to do the fun at night because I was chosen to drive a truck and bring the troops back. Well, when you crawl on your belly or on your back with your rifle, you get dirty. And the guys were tired when I got them back about 9 o'clock at night. And they just put their guns, their rifles in the rack and hit the shower and went to bed. Well, the next day we were on the grenade range and the sergeants went through and checked the rifles. Most of them were dirty. I got to go back about 3:30 in the afternoon. I had plenty of time until I had to pull my truck at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. So I cleaned. Oh, and my drill sergeant gave me the keys to his car. He said, "This is what my car looks like. It's in the parking lot. And the front seat on the floor, rather, is a gallon of gasoline mixed with oil. It's called cleaning fluid. You didn't use gasoline in the Army to clean your rifle." So he said, "It's cleaning fluid. Gasoline mixed with oil, motor oil.
If anybody asks."
In case anybody asks. So I took that into barracks, cleaned my thing, put it where he told me to put it, and then I sat down and rested for a while, pulled, and then everybody's rifle was dirty, except mine, and a few other people who took the time to clean them. And I was always interested in firearms. My 61st year as a life member of the National Rifle Association. My father talked me into buying a life membership because it was cheaper. And I was always interested in firearms. It turns out that a month before I went into basic training, the National Rifle Magazine had a layout of the rifle range in Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Of all places.
Of all places and of all things. So I knew what I was getting into. I knew what it was going to be like. And to me, the M14 was still the best rifle. I shot on the rifle team in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and I used match-grade M14s.
A lot of people are fans of the M14, 7.62 caliber. Not a lightweight, easy-to-maneuver weapon, but I understand fairly accurate and fairly dependable. Okay.
Yeah, we had one Jewish boy, I remember, small, short, and skinny, and no muscles on him at all. His arms were about as big as this water bottle. And he couldn't cock that action the way we were supposed to. Just hold it with one hand, blade part of your, pull it back, and push the catch in. He couldn't do that. The sergeants allowed him to put it up on his hip, like this.
Wow.
That was funny.
Wow, I'll bet. Okay, so Fort Gordon to Fort Huachuca, September 65.
I met somebody at Fort Gordon who had done reserve work,
okay.
Reserve training at Fort Huachuca. I said, "What's it like?" And he told me about what it was like. I said, "What are the whacks like?"
Oh, yeah.
He said, "Oh," he said, "there are 200 whacks and about 2,000 GI. So I said to myself, I said, "Self, you don't stand a chance."
Right, right. WAC, Women's Army Corps.
That's right. So I went to Fort Huachuca in September, and the young lady said it was warm out there. She's right. I had my long sleeve khakis on with a tie tucked in. And Army Security Agency, we were allowed to carry our own records. Medical records, financial records, 201 records, the whole thing. Everybody else, I understand, had to have it shipped ahead of time. So I'm walking around post, turning in my records, and wondering why I'm not perspiring. It's warm. And I find out, this is dry heat.
It's a dry heat.
We're a mile high in altitude at Fort Huachuca, same as Denver.
Yes.
A mile high.
Yes.
And they called it the high desert. Loved it. Loved Fort Huachuca. This young lady didn't like Fort Huachuca, and some of my buddies were taking driver training classes, and they said, "Hey, we got a date with a couple of whacks." Well, most whacks I saw looked like they dragged their knuckles in the ground and looked like the starting lineup of the Pittsburgh Steelers.
That's right.
So I said, "Well, maybe they got a friend." So they had a friend.
What?
60 years ago, a little more than 60 years ago. So we met on a blind date. We had dinner at a nice little restaurant in Sierra Vista. Sierra Vista's not like it used to was. Changed completely. And then we were on our... I borrowed a friend's car. We were on our way to Tombstone because I love Tombstone. And She started falling asleep. I pulled into the desert, turned around, took her back to what we call the wax shack, where the wax were billeted. And then that was in the middle of November, 65. Then I went back, came back to Pennsylvania for Christmas. She went back to Missouri, southeast Missouri, for Christmas. Then I drove my car back, a little Volkswagen, I think it was a 61 Volkswagen with a sunroof. I drove that back to the fort. I remember my mother said, "Now, every night you call and let me know where you are, but call collect." Each city had a name like a person's name where I stopped. So I asked for that person, Snyder. I would say that. She'd say, "No, he's not here right now. Call back." So she'd know where I was.
That's clever.
Yeah.
That's clever. And she wouldn't have to take the charge.
When I went through St. Louis, I stopped to call. "Is Louis Snyder there?" "No, I'm sorry, he's not here. Call back later." So she knew I was in St. Louis. On out through the west to Oklahoma, New Mexico, and then in Arizona.
So we
used to go to, after we met again in January, I'm driving my buddies home from where we worked back to our barracks, and there were these three WACs standing up on the steps of where they worked. The one guy said, "Hey, I know them." I went, made a quick U-turn, pulled in the front, asked if they wanted a ride. Well, I had six adults in that VW.
Oh.
Now, we had a cabin in the Pocono Mountains where I was lifeguard for a couple of years before I went in the Army, and I loaded 17 kids into that VW.
Jeez.
And even drove in a little circle in the parking lot. So now I have six adults, and we're sitting like sardines.
Well, you missed your calling. You should have been a loadmaster in the Air Force.
Should have been.
Being able to pack stuff in like that.
Well, Effie's introducing her girlfriends to us. She remembered Alan's name, Dennis' name, but she forgot my name.
Well,
I had her write it on the board 100 times, so she knows it now.
Okay.
So after that, then we started dating.
And the rest is history. Now you're 60 years into this marriage. And that's a pattern I've noticed between the other people we've talked to. And we think that's just as incredible as it is beautiful. So good for both of you. So you were still 21 at Fort Huachuca. You had your first pizza at the age of 21 while you're at Fort Huachuca. So that's pretty significant too, in addition to getting married. There was a classified environment. Everything was involved code words and secret squirrel ways of doing things. And y'all had to change the code word system because President Johnson messed up the code word system inadvertently because he wasn't, well.
And then
you got married. Effie got out to be your full-time wife, and you requested work overseas, and you went to Berlin. Okay. So you got to Berlin, and Berlin was a split city during the Cold War, literally.
Uh-huh.
The Allies had one side, the U.S., U.K., and France, and the Soviet Union had the other side. There was a wall down the middle of the city, and on one side of the wall you had the depths of communism, and on the other side of the wall you had capitalism and pursuit of Western ideals.
Yep.
Tell us about what that was.
Well, through the British sector, the wall wasn't finished yet. They had knocked down the buildings, the houses, and they were two and three stories tall. And the only thing that remained was the brick front of the house. The doors and the windows were bricked up. On the top of the wall, they had laid wet cement into which they had placed shards of broken glass and pieces of barbed wire. Mm-hmm. And the other side was about 100 yards, well, they call it 100 meters, of a death strip. And they're supposed to have had mines through there, but I learned later through history that they never mined it.
Mm-hmm.
And the dogs were fierce looking, and they weren't toothless, but I understand they weren't as dangerous as attack dogs as the Soviets and the East Germans wanted you to know.
Okay.
Part of West Berlin and the very south in the American sector where it faced East Germany. And all along the wall, there was these platforms, wooden platforms that you could climb and look over the wall. And they stood about as far as I am from the front row, so you couldn't jump over. And we'd go down there every once in a while, and we'd look over the wall. Just the other side of the wall at this place we used to go to a lot was a big house, and you could see the street coming up to the wall and stopping there. And there was an old Oma, which is a German word for grandmother. Mm-hmm. She was on top there, and she was looking, watching the children over there. And she told us that those were her grandchildren, and that's the only way she got to see them. And they're marching around with red flags over their shoulders and saluting and all that. And in the British sector, the memorial that we have pictures of was Peter Fletcher when he was 18. I can't remember the year, 61 or 62. He and his brother were escaping from the East. They hit the wall. His brother got over and safe, and he was hung up on the barbed wire, and he was shot by the East Germans, and he was left there all day long to bleed to death. And there's a beautiful memorial, a black wreath and a plaque that commemorates that. I hope that's still there. It's just very close to Checkpoint Charlie, and we saw Checkpoint Charlie. I was not allowed to go to the East.
Right.
She wasn't allowed to go to the East.
Right.
And because of our security clearances. I was teaching swimming, and I had some kids whose fathers were in the Air Force, and they'd invite us Sunday for dinner at their apartment, and they'd have these beautiful 12-piece dinnerware sets and silver sets. I said, where'd you get that? East Berlin. What did it cost? $7-$8? But then what they did was they took their U.S. dollars, went to the proper place to trade them. We got 4-1 in those days, 4 marks for $1. Then they took the West marks up to a secret place somewhere in the British sector, okay, and they traded those West marks for East marks, and they got about 20-1.
Jeez.
So if you're buying something for $6, it really cost probably about $30.
Wow.
Something like that.
Wow.
So I guess that's called the black market.
No.
No. Well, the only black market that we were involved in was our landlady was a smoker, and she loved Winston's. So she said, you get your telephone free. I won't charge you for the telephone. Just give me 2 cartons of Winston a month.
Gee whiz, that's a lot of cigarettes.
So we did. And that's the only... We had ration cards in Berlin.
Right.
Gasoline,
yep.
Tobacco, mm-hmm. Sugar. I can't remember what all.
Mm-hmm.
And we used our liquor once in a while. And I smoked a pipe, so that wasn't rationed. I could buy pipe tobacco anywhere.
Sure.
And I got a monthly care package from our local VFW back home. And besides the cookies and the cakes and the toothbrush and socks and stuff, there was always a packet of Lucky Strikes, which I give away.
But, all right. Excuse me. So obviously you enjoyed the British sector. And for future reference, the whole situation in Berlin was a fascinating part of history, sometimes dangerous, sometimes mundane, but nonetheless vigilant all the time. Let's talk just for a second about that. You were there in February of 68 when North Korea captured the USS Pueblo.
Yes.
And this led to an increased security posture where you were by the Soviets. Tell us about that.
Well, as you said, the North Korean and Chinese armies captured the USS Pueblo, a United States Navy spy vessel. She was 15 miles off the coast of North Korea. 12 miles was international waters, so she was safe. But they pirated her anyway. One sailor was killed while they were still at sea. Commander Bucher was trying to explain to them that he was only oceanographic research. Meanwhile, they're throwing all the files overboard as fast as they can. And it was very shallow there, so they could have picked everything up as easily, and they were finally towed back. But the Russian tank corps had West Berlin completely surrounded for those 11 months. We would go down to that same place where we looked over the wall, and you could see the Russian tanks every 100 meters. They revved 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and halfway between it was a fuel truck. When the tank ran out of fuel, they filled them. When the tankers ran out of fuel, they left. Another one took its place right away. 11 months, they never stopped running. You could smell the diesel diesel fumes in the air while you're standing there watching and taking pictures.
11 months is basically
a year.
A tank wall.
Yeah.
Idling, ready to go into action at any time.
If the Russians had come through the wall then or any time before or after, everybody in ASA was the first to leave. The buses lined up. We had three sites in the field and a headquarters. The headquarters was the old Prussian Cadet Corps Academy, where Goering trained and the Red Baron and all that, very historical. The buses lined up to take everybody away. There was a contingency team that stayed at the site, and they destroyed it. But we had our filing cabinets, I was telling Rich, were made out of steel and concrete.
Mm-hmm.
Steel reinforced. They were about an inch and a half wide, filled with concrete. It took three guerrillas and half the starting lineup of the Pittsburgh Steelers to move those
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
And we had these grenades. You pulled the pin, set it on top. 3 seconds, it burned right through all the steel, the concrete, through the floor, down to the basement, continued burning through the concrete.
Yep.
So that destroyed the files. And when everything was destroyed, the MP came by with his 45. Everybody got a shot, got one for himself, so that nobody could come out, because the Soviets had, bounties on us.
Wow.
Same in Vietnam. The North Korean, the Chinese and North Koreans had a bounty on every ASA man in Vietnam, and they had bounties on us. Earlier, years before we went there, anybody in ASA was not allowed to go out and walk the streets without less than 6 other people with you. In case you were jumped, you could fight them off.
Jeez.
And we had, as I said, we had 3 sites. And one of my jobs in S2 was to carry a 45, loaded, cocked, and ready to go, and carried classified documents from this site to that site to the headquarters, even went up to Temple Hof to the Air Force Security Squadron once in a while, and picked up documents from them and took documents there that we traded.
So there's 4 basic shops in the Army. It has 4 basic functions. And the S2, which you mentioned, is the intel function. And I also want to mention this for a minute, because he was locked and loaded and ready to go. The Army isn't known for its safety record with locked and loaded firearms, so it's a rare occasion when in the normal course of your duty, you even have one in the chamber. So this should help us understand a little bit what that higher posture was for that work in Berlin at the time. It's absolutely fascinating.
Well, I have a 1911 45 that I carry all the time. I don't have it with me now, but it's always, there's one in the chamber and the safety's on. And a 45 has a double safety, so there's no chance of anything happening.
Right.
But we had to clear them when we got back to the headquarters.
Yep.
And check it in again. And every time we needed it, off we went.
That's interesting. And I was in the military police, and even when we were carrying, we were never that ready with the weapons. So that's interesting. All right, so here's some interesting things. In the civilian clothes stores at the time, there were no changing rooms.
Oh, in the department stores?
Yes.
Yeah, the biggest department store in Berlin and the poshest and probably the biggest in Europe was called the Kadewe. No, I can't remember what it means anymore. Kadewe is KDW. And it must have been 6 floors and a couple of city blocks big, but the way we measure city blocks here. And there were changing rooms, but the men and the women didn't use them.
Oh.
If you're going to try on a
pair of pants,
another dress or a slip, you took everything off, laid it on the counter, and you put this on. And the escalator is going up here, and the GIs go by. You know, it was an afternoon fun. Well, I was married at the time, so we bought clothing there in the Kadewe, and we watched every movie that was made in Berlin or about Berlin. They were all spy movies.
Yes,
and we found different night spots in the Burning Section. The Burning Section was the best place to go because they had all the night spots. They had all the night spots, the Café au Lait, the Eierschule. Eierschule means eggshell, and they had live Dixie band music there every night. That was so nice to go there, and we'd go to the British. I worked, the biggest site we were on was called Teufelsberg. It means Devil's Mountain. It was built on, maybe you can tell something about that. It was built on in the forest called the Grunewald. It was made, the hill was about 13 acres on the top, and I think about not quite 200 feet high. And it was built on the rubble that was carried out after Berlin was bombed. And it was built on top of a building a school that Hitler had designated, but I don't think it was ever used, for small weapons training for the Gestapo and the SS. And we built that hill there. It just happened to be in the British sector, but the Americans had the idea of building a listening post there, and we got the permission of the British. We built it, and it was manned by both American Army Security and British RAF. And we had a lot of friends in the RAF, and we'd take breaks together. Of course, I didn't know what they did. We didn't know what they did. They didn't know what we did. But they had their tea, we had our coffee, and we'd shoot the ball. And it was only a couple of years ago that I emailed one of my British friends. I asked the question, what did King George do with the Declaration of Independence? He said, I don't know. I didn't care for history. He said, I was languages. He mastered French in high school, and he mastered Russian and German, and that's what he did in Berlin. He was in the RAF for 20 years, and the only place he could work was in Berlin.
The RAF, said, oh, Royal Air Force.
Royal Air Force, yeah. So he translated intercepted messages, voice messages, in Russian and German. And we would go over there to their place, and we'd visit with them, and we'd eat in what they called their NAFI, stands for Navy, Army, Air Force Institute. It was like RPX, where they served food, they had snack bars, and so they had a better department store than the American PX did. And we'd go to the British cinema and watch their movies. We never went to the French section because we didn't speak French.
Well, and why would you, when the British section, for example, had at least one nightclub where there was a telephone on each table?
Oh, yes.
Table-to-table telephones. So if I want to talk to that pretty girl at that table over there, I just got to pick up the phone at my table and ring her up at her table.
Yeah.
You went out to a nice restaurant one time and had to borrow a tie to eat in a decent restaurant. He's holding up the tie he borrowed.
I had a jacket, obviously slacks on, and a shirt, and we had to wear either a shirt buttoned or a tie when we went out.
And that's still a good-looking tie.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I wear it occasionally, but I didn't have a tie, so he wouldn't let me in. He said, come back here. So I went behind the counter. He pulled his drawer out full of ties. He said, pick one out. So I'm rooting through. This one looked okay. So I picked his tie out. I put it on that we can go in and we could eat at the restaurant and do business in there.
Well chosen on the tie. You were a pretty good swimmer and a swimming instructor in addition to being a lifeguard when you were younger. And you taught fellow GIs how to swim in an indoor pool that Adolf Hitler commissioned for exclusive use by SS officers. Did it occur to you the historical significance of that while you were doing it?
I didn't know that Hitler had built it for the SS recreation. I thought it was the Olympic pool during the 36,
okay.
But it wasn't built until 2 years later.
Okay.
But it was a huge pool. It was an Olympic-sized pool. The shallow end was 8 feet deep. And the other end, with a 10-meter board, was as deep,
wow.
15 to 16 feet deep.
Sounds like a nice pool.
But I had been teaching dependent swimming, not in that pool, in the British Olympic pool up in the British sector, where it was really shallow in the one end. The commanding general wanted to have a yacht on the Wannsee, on the lake. So he said, I need 5 MPs to run the boat and to be lifeguard for me. So they picked out, and I don't know how I got chosen, but I was chosen. I gave them senior life-saving instruction. Red Cross Senior Life Saving Badge.
Mm-hmm.
That was about 6 weeks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught 5 MPs, I think a half a day. It was only about a couple hours a day. And we did that. And I taught dependent children to day and evening classes I had. Got me out of some work, you know. But
so George, spent some time with George. I'm proud to call him friend. He also turned a scout troop, a Boy Scout troop, from practically death into a Boy Scout troop that ultimately had 86 boys in it while you were there. He got promoted twice, finally to Specialist E5 while he was there. And your son was born there.
Yeah.
And you've relayed to me that Berlin, therefore, for all those reasons, and for the fun and for the experience, was a pretty significant part of your life.
Very significant. Effie and I celebrated many firsts there. Our first Thanksgiving, our first Christmas, our first Easter, our first anniversary, which we spent in Bremerhaven on the Baltic Sea, and our first child was born there. So we say with Marlene Dietrich, "Ich habe ein Koffer in Berlin. I have a suitcase in Berlin. There's still something there of ours."
And there always will be. And part of you will always be there, yeah, too.
I said, too, shortly after we got to Berlin, I fell in love with another woman, Marlene Dietrich.
Yeah.
I never met her.
Spy,
I love that voice. One of the Air Force sergeant's houses we went to for lunch, he was playing Dietrich records. And who has that sultry voice? Dietrich. We watched, I don't know how many movies ever. Der Blau Engel, mm-hmm, both in English and in German. Mm-hmm. Didn't understand the German very well, but I knew what was happening. So, yeah, Marlene Dietrich. We also were youth directors for the Protestant youth of the chapel. So every Sunday night we had a chapel service. And then afterwards, on the way home, we stopped by this restaurant called the Wienerwald. They made chicken and Wiener Schnitzel. We went every Sunday night, we stopped in there. One night, one of the booths was gone, and a little piano was sitting there with a little man playing the piano with a big tip jar in the corner. So we sat down, we ordered, and I walked up to him and said, "Lily Marlene." It's a song that she sings. He played. He stopped playing what he was playing and started playing "Lily Marlene." And when we left, 5 mark tip, $1.25. Back in '65, that was a lot of money. Every night we walked in after that, he'd see us, he'd stop playing what he was playing, "No, Lily Marlene."
And you enjoyed that, and he enjoyed,
yes,
the tip. And
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. February 69, you did your time, and you got out. Okay. Came back to the States, happy husband, proud papa, Army veteran. You hung around home for a bit, for a while, and then went to Bible college. Became ordained. Took a church in Maine for a while.
4 years. Yeah.
Okay. Then another one nearby in Ellsworth, and then finally one on Mount Washington.
Right.
Which is how you came to Pittsburgh/Carnegie.
Pretty much so, yeah.
36 years ago. And you've been in Carnegie ever since.
Right.
And we'll get to some of that in a minute. Beyond all the things we've already talked about, you're also a magician of a sort.
Of a sort.
And we're going to see some magic after this. You're a pretty decent carpenter based on the small things that I've seen. And you were quite the dancer. Any other skills, hidden skills that George Snyder has that he doesn't talk about very often that we need to know about?
My father never complained when he was at work and we were little growing up, taking his tools and some of the wood that he had laying around and baking things. They weren't very clever things, but he never minded that. And we climbed on the roof and helped him build and helped him demolish things and rebuild. And,
okay.
And so I grew up, and we built a cabin in the Poconos,
oh,
in 1960, and Dad got a whole truckload of secondhand lumber and joists to build two cabins, 30 by 30.
Okay,
so cabins. So we got all the, he laid the cement blocks, and then we started building it up from there. So we had, I don't know how long, I think the late 50s until 70, late 70s, my parents had the cabin in the Poconos. They go to Florida every winter, but when they came back, they found people had broken into the cabin and stole things and destroyed things. So
right.
They sold and moved back home.
Right.
Oh, I used to draw cartoons, yeah. I was a cartoonist for a school newspaper.
Really?
But that wasn't much.
Well, it's a skill, I certainly. So good for you. All right, so let's get to where we are. You're the official chaplain for our local chapters of the American Legion and the VFW, okay? I've also heard you lead prayers and make presentations for other civic and veteran-oriented organizations in the area. Why do you continue to do this for those groups? And I get it. Reverends are called to serve forever, but you could do this work for anyone, and you told me that you even did a prison ministry for a while. But why do you choose to continue to operate in these spaces, in the military and the veteran spaces?
We're patriotic.
Good answer.
We love the world, the country.
Good answer.
And we want to do whatever we can to help and to promote. We'd like to see more people join the VFW and the American Legion, especially young people.
Yes.
They're just not they just don't seem to be joiners. Before we joined the Legion down here about 10 years ago, I understand they gave free membership to the Gulf era veterans. They gave free membership for a year, hoping that, and the fellas took advantage of it. They came to the Legion, they came to the VFW, they participated, they had participated in the events and so on. Then the next year, they didn't come back, but we don't know why.
Well, you can't go to any of these places or any of these events in this town without seeing you and Effie there, and that's, for what it's worth, I've witnessed that myself, and I commend that, and I always look forward to seeing you both out there. How would you say, other than this drive to continue to operate in these areas, were you changed by your time in the Army at all? Good or bad?
I wasn't a bad kid growing up. I mean, we didn't. In those days, most of the kids our age didn't get into trouble. There were a few mavericks in school. Now, I went to a school that had both from 7th grade to 12th grade, and there were a few of the older boys that got into trouble once in a while. But for the most part, we didn't. Of course, we would have had hell to pay if we'd have gotten into trouble at school or elsewhere, and you know, so we just didn't. We I think people were more respectful of everything, the law, elders. You didn't talk back to an elder, even if it was a neighbor. No, you didn't talk back, or they just smacked you down.
I sense that the Army strengthened a good foundation that you were fortunate enough to have before you enlisted.
Yeah, you asked about how training was.
Yeah.
I should have mentioned that I was in marching band. In Boy Scouts, we marched, and from 7th to 12th grade, our gym teacher, we always did close order drill the first 15 to 20 minutes of class. So when I got the basic training, I knew my left from my right. I knew forward march. I knew about face. I there was nothing I didn't know as far as marching was concerned. So that was easy. It was not only easy, but it was fun. And in Georgia, when we marched to and from school, there was usually a black kid that fall out of a formation, and he would call cadence. Man, that was so much fun. I'd still love to do that today if I could find, if one of our VFW or the Legion had some kind of a close order.
I get it. And cadence is when somebody sings in time so that you can keep your step either while you're marching or while you're double timing, running. And a good cadence singer can make or break.
Oh, absolutely.
Where you are going, it's hard to beat. It's a unique joy. What do you want your community to know about veterans in general, given this platform and given the platform for at least a generation or two from now? What do you want Carnegie to know about veterans as you've continued to spend time with them?
Well, to have respect for veterans, to have respect for their country and their flag, which seems to be lacking in some places today anymore. We just love to go up, have lunch at Mission Barbecue, and we always try to be there about 11:30,
yep,
so that we're there by noon.
Yep.
When they ask everybody to stand and sing the national anthem. And we do, and we salute. I understand months ago there was an incident where somebody absolutely refused to stand. The manager came out after the national anthem, gave him his money back, and said, please leave and don't come back.
Excellent. Good. Yeah, see you later.
Yeah.
If you can't stand up here in the anthem, then just don't go away. Okay, so this is the last thing, and I'm going to remind you, because I think it's a good lesson for people that might be considering joining the military later, and for those of us that have been in, they're going to know exactly what you're talking about. You learned pretty quick when you got to training to be in the middle.
Oh, yes. That was this is February of 1965. 2 o'clock in the morning, we got into camp, Fort Dix, and I think we got our basic issue. No, we didn't. We got a long overcoat and a hat, and there was about 200 guys, and we marched up to the con mess, a consolidated mess hall. Just by coincidence, I happened to be somewhere in the middle of the group. And that was good for a lot of reasons. It was cold and it was windy. I thought, you know what? I'm a little guy, and here are all these tall guys. They're breaking the wind. It's like standing behind a wall. And not only that, but some of the bigger guys would muscle up to the front first two rows. And then the mess sergeant comes out and says, first two rows, fall out and follow me. They were serving, and they got to eat last. They thought they were going to eat first. We moved up two rows. It put me two rows closer to the front, but we still waited. And I learned very quickly, try to be in the middle and try not to get the sergeants to know who you are, yes. Know your name. Yes. Be inconspicuous. Yep.
And literally and figuratively, that's a good place to be.
It didn't always work because when we got to Fort Huachuca, I had two buddies. One was a Hawaiian boy, and the other was a boy from, I think, Washington State. The three of us hung out all the time. And the first sergeant loved his Hawaiian boy, and he loved to come out and hit him on the – he showed his affection for you by hitting you on the shoulder with his – and he was a mountain, this first sergeant. But anyway, so he knew my name.
Uh-oh.
But I never got into trouble. I don't know. They give you a good conduct medal if you serve 3 years without staying out of trouble. Or sometimes some guys say that means you just didn't get caught.
Well, there is that, maybe. I can't confirm or deny. Okay. Any questions for George or his service from anybody? Frank Palami says, thank you for your service, George.
You're welcome, Frank. Yeah, Frank plays with a group at the VFW every Tuesday from about 2 to maybe 4. He plays bass guitar, and we have a lady now that joined the group, and she plays saxophone. Really adds a lot to it. But at any rate, Frank Palumbi. Oh, yeah. Grace sings once in a while.
I know, they're good.
They're all good.
It's a good little lineup. Yeah. Anybody else for George?
Good.
We covered.
I didn't study.
Thank you so much. Signing off. Until next time.